helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel. Becoming a parent means taking on a lot of responsibility. Yes, there's the feeding and clothing of our children, but keep in mind, one of the most important responsibilities is to raise our children to be adults. I mean more than just growing up. I mean training our children to be good and productive people and prepared to be free citizens in this great republic. Now, for decades, we have expected government schools to train our children. Now, recent evidence shows that the education system, well, it's been corrupted. For years, we've heard of reports of failing schools, unsafe schools, and illiterate graduates. But when the COVID lockdowns allowed the parents to see what their children were being taught, well, many of them were ready to revolt against the system. Now, while there are many things parents can do to improve the education of their children, it all starts with them taking responsibility for the raising of their own children. Well, hello there, everyday Americans. Paul Engel here with the Constitution Study, and today I want to talk about our need to protect our children from our schools. See, when I was a child, there were two places that were considered safe for that my parents could leave me. One was the school, and yes, I'm a product of public schools. We're talking public schools. Well, the other was the public library. And I don't want to talk about libraries today. Today, I'm focusing on schools. And I'm actually going to start with higher education, and I think you'll understand why in just a minute. See, there's a recent report by the McKinsey and Company. It was published back in the middle of July, and it found that Black, Latino, Native American, and Pacific Islander students have worse academic outcomes as measured by graduation rates when compared to their white and Asian counterparts. This is after years, if not decades, of pouring God knows how much money into diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts on these same college campuses. So if pouring money into these campuses is not leading to better outcomes, why? What can we do? Now, it appears that the report blames the inequities in K-12 education, and that how that impacts a student's preparation for college admissions and for succeeding in higher education. But what's interesting is while the McKinsey analysts appear to encourage schools to reflect on their institution's historical and current role in creating and perpetuating racial and ethnical inequities, I think that the answer is different. So I've been watching some interviews with Thomas Sowell. He is a brilliant economist, and he did a series of interviews. I forget which group organization it was, but if you search the videos for Thomas Sowell, you'll probably feel it spelled S-O-W-E-L-L. And he talks about a lot of things. And one of the things he talks about is what life was like when he was a child and a young man in Harlem back in the 40s and 50s. He pointed out that the literacy rates among minorities was higher back then. He points out that the success rate of minorities was higher back then. Of course, he also points out that the stability of families among minorities was higher back then. But there's a couple things he points out. And again, correlation is not causation, but he points out a couple of things. One is the value that many minority families placed on education, the understanding that education was a tool to your future success. And he points out how that has been lost as minority communities have become more and more dependent on government rather than their families for their survival. As they give up, as the family becomes less the center of your world, and it becomes government actions. You become dependent on government for food and for shelter and for education. As this has grown, the family has crumbled, and correlating with that, we see a lack of interest in education. we even see this idea now that being interested in education is considered white. I don't know how reading, writing, and arithmetic can be considered racial, but it is. And it's leading the American children to not be prepared for future education, whether it be higher education, whether it be a trade school. If you're not learning the basics, you are at a deficit in this world, especially as our economy moved from manufacturing to information to whatever's coming next. You see, when I was in school in the late 60s and 70s, in fact, I went to school in New York City, public schools. I lived in Chelsea, in Manhattan. And we spent most of our time working on reading, writing, arithmetic. Yeah, we did a little bit of social studies and history. And even when I moved upstate, we still focused a lot of time on useful skills, functional skills, the basic understanding of being able to read and write properly, read and write so that you could communicate with others, to use the basic arithmetic so you could live your life, so you could do things like, you know, balance a checkbook and other basic things, you know, carpentry and whatnot. But as we've seen over the years, see, back then when I was a child in the New York City public school system, parents were still expected to be involved. Now, it was transitioning, right? So that you didn't have parents involved routinely in the everyday, but, you know, you had the parent-teacher conferences, and the parents were informed, and the parents and the teachers communicated, and that seems to have been going by the wayside. And as that interaction, as that parental involvement has diminished, we turned over our children to the government thinking, oh, no, they're public schools, and they're full of professionals. So we're going to turn them over to the professionals to educate, because, well, the professionals, they know better, don't they? But we never seem to stop and think, wait a second, where are the professionals? What makes a professional a professional? Where is the training they're getting to make them a professional? And as I've seen over the years, the not simply the lack of involvement of parents, but actually going to the active separation, the schools pushing back from parents being involved, we see more and more time, that kids are spending more and more time in school focusing less and less on the basic skills they need and more on social agendas. So again, last year when we had all the brouhaha in Virginia about CRT and about the transgender movement and the covering up of potential crimes by transgender young men, I wasn't thoroughly surprised. We didn't send my daughter to public school. My wife agreed. We were not going to do that. We had seen what public schools had turned into. And even when I was a child, you know, it was still a bit Lord of the Flies, but it has gone crazy. So we kept our children up, but we have friends and family that sent their children to public school, and we would see what was being taught and where they were spending their time. And now, as this information is coming out, because, well, if your child is not going to school but taking class right in your living room, the parents got to see what was going on. And what's happening truly is, I wish it was inconceivable. Sadly, it's perfectly conceivable. It's just the American parents have sat back and said, we'll just let the professionals do it. So what are some of these professionals teaching our children? Well, they seem to be obsessed with two things, race and sex. Now, again, when I was a teenager, you know, in high school, we had sex education, and it focused primarily on the biology of how babies are made, with a lot of warning. This is at the early in the AIDS epidemic, the AIDS scare, so we had a lot of information about safe sex. But nothing like what we're talking about today. I mean, I'm reading story after story of parents finding out that teachers and administrators and counselors in their government schools are encouraging, some would say indoctrinating, would be training, grooming young children into the transsexual lifestyle. Children as young as 10 being told that, oh, well, you look a little different. You act a little different. You may be transsexual. You know, I find it amazing that after years of being told that we should break down the stereotypes, now, if you don't meet the stereotypes, you're considered, the sexual stereotypes, you're considered transgender. Bloody amazing. And then, of course, you have the 1619 Project and the CRT. And all I could think of is we are handing our children over to government experts that have been trained to indoctrinate them into a sexualized, racist lifestyle. And the American parents, they're not doing anything about it. And the few that find out and stand up, well, of course, they're vilified. They are, they're called transphobic. They're called, even parents that say, listen, we don't have a problem with how our child ends up. We don't want the government encouraging it. We don't want the government moving them, trying to persuade them a certain way. I mean, just look at the reaction to the Florida law that says you're not allowed to talk about you're only allowed to talk about sex to children K through 12 as a age appropriate. And what was the reaction of academia? It's don't say gay. It says nothing about being gay. It says you can't talk about gay. You can't talk about transsexual. You can't talk about heterosexual. Don't sexualize our children before they're ready. But you see, if all you do is hand your child over to government, that's what's happening. Now again, my wife and I, we had made the conscious decision before our daughter was born that whatever it took, she would not be in a public school. We had worked for, we had decided actually that we wanted one of us home with her, that we would be a one-income family. Now, I had a good job. I made a good wage, turned into a very good career. So my wife was the one that stayed home with our daughter. And we decided to homeschool. And it, to me, it made a tremendous difference as I see how so many public school children are taught to behave compared to how my daughter behaves. You know, we were asked frequently, you know, aren't you worried about socialization? And our response was, yes, we're very concerned about socialization. That's why she's not in public school. We're not, you know, we're not going to expose her to the bullying and the groupthink and the go along to get along mentality. We want her to think. And guess what? She's one of the best socialized children. Most of our, most parents that met us would tell us how wonderful she is, how well socialized she is. We didn't hide her, we didn't isolate her, we chose not to expose her to this dangerous environment. And yes, schools have become dangerous environments, not all schools, but a lot of the public schools have become dangerous environments for the raising of children unless you want them to be sexually and racially obsessed. And of course, it's not just the schools. Boston's Children's Hospital, a nationally known, internationally known children's hospital, recently posted a video claiming that hysterectomies are a form of gender-affirming medical care. I mean, just think about that. You're a parent in Boston, let's say, and you're in the Boston Public Schools. And, you know, if the government says, hey, you know, you get to the right age, we'll let the kids decide and make lifelong changes to their bodies, changes that cannot be fully reversed. And our children are being indoctrinated with this idea. Yeah, go ahead, to the point where hospitals are doing this. And the funny thing is, I keep thinking about Johns Hopkins University. Their hospital, University Hospital, the inventor of the sex change operation that stopped performing sex change operations. And you know why? Because they found no benefit, no benefit to the operation. It did not deal with the problems. It did not make the person feel better. It did not improve their emotional state. Everything we're told that this mutilation will do, they found it didn't do. So Johns Hopkins University stopped doing it. And now nationwide, if your children are in school, in a government school, or even exposed to government health care, there's a chance that without your knowledge, they'll be racialized, they'll be sexualized, they could possibly be mutilated, and you only find out after the fact. And in fact, in some cases, if you try to tell them, wait until you're grown up, wait until you've figured this out, the state will take your child away. No, it's important that we as parents, take responsibility for raising our children. Regardless of what school they go to, we must be in oversight. Now, I'm going to talk about a recent court case that involves tuition assistance, a state tuition assistance program, but I got to take a break first. And I want to remind you to take a look at HealthyCell.com. They've got some tremendous supplements. They're a leading provider of supplements that work at the cellular level. Now, one of them is called Focus and Recall. I love this. It helps my short-term focus. It helps my long-term mental retention. And it's easy to use. I use it. My daughter uses it. We love this stuff. You can get 20% off Focus and Recall or anything from Healthy Cell for your first order. Just go to HealthyCell.com and use the code OUTLOUD. Once again, that's HealthyCell.com. Use the code OUTLOUD. You'll get 20% off your first order, whether it's Focus and Recall or anything you put together. So once again, head to HealthyCell.com. Check out the Focus and Recall. Use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. And then join me right back after this break, and we'll talk about tuition assistance out of the state of Maine.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. If you find yourself always distracted or having trouble recalling information, you're likely to fall behind in the demanding, fast-paced 21st century. In other words, brain performance is more critical now than ever. Boost your brain power with Healthy Cells Focus Plus Recall. Science-backed nootropics to sharpen focus, concentrate longer, enhance recall, improve mental speed, learn rapidly, and be more alert. It's a pill-free brain supplement made with maximum absorption technology, designed to feed our brains at the cellular level. Take it for a test drive. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Focus Plus Recall. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
As Americans, we seek to form a more perfect union. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And God willing, we shall not perish from the earth. AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Oral hygiene hasn't changed in 50 years. Brush, floss, repeat. We're told to use fluoride, which doesn't really address the acid-creating bacteria. That is where the dentist-recommended Spry Dental Defense System shines. Spry products contain xylitol, a natural sugar, which helps get rid of those nasty, smelly acid-creating bacteria in our mouth. The best way to care for your teeth and gums is by using Spry. The Spry Dental Defense System has a wide variety of products. Toothpaste, mouthwash, mints, and chewing gums that are designed to work together to keep your teeth clean and mouth healthy and smelling sweet all day long. To get your oral care back on track in an easy, effective, and very tasty way, switch to Spry today. Ask your dentist about xylitol and the Spry products. Spry can be found online and at all fine natural product retailers.
Thank you.
welcome back, everyday Americans. If you join the Constitution Study, let's get right into this article I wrote about Maine's tuition assistance program and its case at the Supreme Court.
When parents saw what their children were being taught during the COVID-19 school shutdowns, well, school choice became a topic of great interest. If government schools were going to substitute political theory for reading, writing, and arithmetic, parents wanted another choice. Now, most people can't afford private schools, and others cannot dedicate the time to homeschooling. Since people pay for these government schools through their taxes, shouldn't they be able to use that money for better options? As the most rural state in the Union, Maine is in a unique situation. Maine's constitution provides that the state's legislature shall require the several towns to make suitable provisions at their own expense for the support and maintenance of public schools. In accordance with that command, the legislature has required that every school-aged child in Maine shall be provided an opportunity to receive the benefits of a free public education. While the Constitution of the state of Maine requires towns to provide for public schools, well, some districts do not have a secondary school. Maine enacted a program to allow parents in these districts to designate another secondary school for their children to attend, either in another district or a private school. And the state would send money to the school to help defray costs. Now, of course, with money comes strings, which two families got caught in. David and Amy Carson sought tuition assistance to send their daughter to Bangor Christian Academy, while Troy and Angela Nelson sent their son to Temple Academy, but could not afford to also send their daughter. There was one problem for these two families, though. Since 1981, Maine has limited tuition assistance to non-sectarian schools. While both schools meet the state's requirements of being accredited by the New England Association of Schools and Colleges, the schools did not qualify as non-sectarian. Petitioners sued the commissioner of the Maine Department of Education, alleging that the non-sectarian requirement violated the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, as well as the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The district court rejected petitioners' constitutional claims and granted judgment for the commissioner, the First Circuit affirmed. Let's start with the complaint. As I've said more than a few times before, this cannot be a First Amendment issue because the law in question did not come from Congress. As the First Amendment states, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, this detail didn't seem to influence the Supreme Court's opinion, though. The Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment protects against indirect coercion or penalties on the free exercise of religion, not just outright prohibitions. Now, it's worth noting that the court did not come to this opinion based on the language of the Constitution. Rather, they once again placed the opinions of previous courts above the supreme law of the land. While this requirement cannot violate the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, it does violate the Constitution of the state of Maine, which states, "All individuals have a natural and unalienable right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own conscience, and no person shall be hurt, molested, or restrained in that person's liberty or estate for worshiping God in the manner and season most agreeable to the dictates of that person's own conscience, nor for that person's religious professions or sentiments, provided that the person does not disturb the public peace nor obstruct others in their religious worship." As the suit alleges, Maine's policy also violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, which reads, "Nor shall any state deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." Does Maine's non-sectarian requirement violate the rights of citizens to equal protection of the law? Well, reading from the opinion, the First Circuit held that the non-sectarian requirement was constitutional because the benefit was properly viewed not as tuition payments to be used at approved private schools, but instead as funding for the rough equivalent of the public school education that Maine may permissibly require to be secular. Okay, the First Circuit Court of Appeals thought the requirement was constitutional because, in their minds, the money wasn't a tuition payment, but school funding. Meanwhile, I'm not sure what that has to do with the constitutionality of the requirement. Can the state of Maine create public schools that are required to be secular? Yes. The court noted, but the statute does not say anything like that. The benefit provided by statute is tuition at a public or private school selected by the parent with no suggestion that the private school must somehow provide a public education. According to the First Circuit, it's okay to discriminate if the funding is for the equivalent of a public education, but not if it's for tuition. Thankfully, the majority of the court did not agree. Maine's non-sectarian requirement of its otherwise generally available tuition assistance payments violates the free exercise of the First Amendment, regardless of how the benefit and restrictions are described. The program operates to identify and exclude otherwise eligible schools on the basis of their religious exercise. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. Justice Breyer dissented with this opinion and was joined by Justices Kagan and Sotomayor. The First Amendment begins by forbidding the government from making any law respecting an establishment of religion. It next forbids them to make any law prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, as I've already shown, the First Amendment forbids Congress, not the government. That came from the Supreme Court, which makes the next quote even more disturbing. The court today pays almost no attention to the words in the first clause while giving almost exclusive attention to the words in the second clause. Actually, the Supreme Court as a whole paid no attention to the words of the First Amendment, period. Like any good lawyer, Justice Breyer is good at playing with words to support his opinion. The majority also fails to recognize this play in the joints between the two clauses. That play gives states some degree of legislative leeway. It sometimes allows a state to further anti-establishment interests by withholding aid from religious institutions without violating the Constitution's protection for the free exercise of religion. The Constitution doesn't have any joints to play with. The First Amendment strictly prohibits Congress, not the states, from abridging the people's right to exercise their religion. What Justice Breyer refers to as anti-establishment interests seem more like anti-religious interests. Continuing from the dissent, in my view, Maine's non-sectarian requirement falls squarely within the scope of that constitutional leeway. I respectfully dissent. It should be no surprise that a justice of the Supreme Court placed their own preferences above the actual language of the law, and that is not the only place Justice Breyer got it wrong. Continuing from his dissent, we have never previously held what the court holds today, namely, that a state must, not may, use state funds to pay for religious education as part of a tuition program designed to ensure the provision of free statewide public school education. Now, as the majority pointed out, nothing in their opinion claims the state must fund religious education. The dissents are wrong to say that under our decision today, Maine must fund religious education. Maine chose to allow some parents to direct state tuition payments to private schools. That decision was not forced upon it. The state retains a number of options. It could expand the reach of its public school system, increase the availability of transportation, provide some combination of tutoring, remote learning, and partial attendance, or even operate boarding schools of its own. As I've already pointed out, the majority of the court sided with the parents. Yes, they claim that Maine's non-sectarian requirement violated the First Amendment. In particular, we have repeatedly held that a state violates the Free Exercise Clause when it excludes religious observers from otherwise available public benefits. However, since the First Amendment specifically prohibits Congress from passing laws abridging the free exercise of religion, it appears once again the court got to the right answer, but for the wrong reasons. What Maine's non-sectarian clause did by singling out religious schools for discrimination was violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So where does that leave this case? Maine may provide a strictly secular education in its public schools, but BCS and Temple Academy, like numerous other recipients of Maine's tuition assistance programs, are not public schools. In order to provide an education to children who live in certain parts of its far-flung state, Maine has decided not to operate schools of its own, but instead to offer tuition assistance that parents may direct to the public or private schools of their choice. Maine's administration of that benefit is subject to the free exercise principles governing any such public benefit program, including the prohibition on denying the benefit based on a recipient's religious exercise. While we should take the win, I think constitutionally minded Americans should also learn from the court's mistake. We may be happy with the outcome, but all it would take for the next group of parents to be discriminated against is a court with a couple of different justices on it. The Establishment Clause does not require a government to be hostile to religious observance or organizations. While there are plenty of government actors, including judges, who may disagree, the Establishment Clause does not require a secular government. It only prohibits a national church. Now, those who have stoked the fears of America becoming a theocracy have used the misinterpretation of Jefferson's separation of church and state to effectively do what they claim to be avoiding, establishing a national religion of secularism. This case is one small step for religious freedom in America. Hopefully, it will lead to a giant leap towards liberty for all.
Now, while the Supreme Court has said that Maine cannot discriminate in its tuition assistance program against religious schools, the states are not the only player in this charade, in this game. You know, we think of schools being primarily state issues, but back in the 1970s, the federal government created a federal Department of Education. This is a complete violation of the Constitution. Education is not a power delegated to the United States, but, you know, we spent so many years ignoring the Constitution, people don't realize that anymore. But it moves that power structure. So we went from parents being the primary teachers of our children, and they would get together and they would hire a teacher. They'd set up a school. They'd hire the teacher. Then it became a state issue, and we more and more parents step back and let the experts come in. Well, now it's now becoming more and more of a federal issue. So really, you shouldn't be surprised. We have a history of the federal government using the Department of Education to intimidate schools to do what the people in the federal government want. The latest example of this is the Biden administration's attempt to get its Department of Agriculture to require schools to allow boys in girls' bathrooms and locker rooms if they want the national school lunch money. So how many of you realize that those free lunch programs, yeah, they get a lot of their money from the federal government. I should say the state's been bribed by the federal government for, here's some free money to give lunch to poor and needy children. And of course, being politicians, they gobble it right up. So now we have the Federal Department of Agriculture saying, if you want this money, you must do what we say. Money always comes with strings. You know, the two families in Maine learned about that. Now, again, the case went their way, but look at what they had to go through because they were taking money from the state. Well, now we're talking about taking money from the federal government. Now, Virginia isn't the only, you know, several of the states actually have joined a lawsuit to stop this. Now, according to Tennessee's Attorney General, who is leading this particular lawsuit, there was a press release. He said the lawsuit seeks to stop the Biden administration from enforcing an expansive and unlawful interpretation of federal anti-discrimination laws under the threat of withdrawing key food assistance program funding. See, this is the part that most people don't pay attention to. When you take money from somebody, well, he who pays the piper calls the tune. So here you have the Department of Agriculture. And notice, the states aren't saying, hey, wait a second, maybe we should not be taking this money from the federal government. Oh, no, 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 no. They're saying we don't like what the federal government is now asking us to do with this money. Now, is providing free lunches to needy children a bad thing? No. Is getting the money from the federal government to do it? Absolutely. But it's the same, it's an extension of the problem we started out with. See, as parents, we turned over the education of our children to government. First, it was a local school board, then it was a state government, now it's to the federal government, which means they are dictating what your children are being taught. You say, but this isn't about curriculum, Paul. No, but it is about saying, listen, you must allow this transgender insanity in your schools. Now, it starts with school lunch money. What happens when it goes beyond that? I mean, we've already seen this administration try to use Title IX to allow men to compete against women in sports, claiming there's no physical, biological difference that matters. This is not a surprise. This is an agenda. See, it's not just the curriculum that teaches your children. If your children go to school and see, oh yeah, there's now a boy in the girls' room, and not only can you not complain about it, but the school says you must allow it, they're being taught that it's right for boys and girls to go to the bathroom together, to shower together, that you're wrong to challenge this idea. See, one of the most amazing things I learned homeschooling our daughter is how often we actually taught her. I actually taught her fractions when she was about 3-4 years old. Yeah, see, I make a big breakfast Saturday mornings. And of course, being a small child, she wanted to help. So when I would make pancakes and I needed a half a cup of this and a quarter cup of that, and I needed to do some math on it, guess what I taught her to do? I taught her fractions and I taught her how to add and subtract and multiply fractions while we were making pancakes. The opportunities are legendary. Here, we had the federal government attempting to teach your children to accept that transgenderism is not only normal, it must be protected against all challenges. That's what your children are being taught in school from the federal government. Now, there are many states that have joined Tennessee in this lawsuit. From a press release, I see Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Georgia, Indiana, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, Utah, Virginia, and West Virginia. They've all joined this lawsuit. But I want you to notice, the lawsuit is not to say, maybe we shouldn't take the federal government's money. It's to force the federal government to stop to give them the money without forcing them to adopt an agenda. In other words, the states are still going to be dependent on this money. They're still going to be subject to the bribe from the federal government. They just don't want to be held accountable to it. Now, I have to take another break, but before I do, hey, do me a favor, check out AmericaOutloud.com. You'll not only find the Constitution Study, but other great authors and speakers with a lot of useful information. And do your part to secure the blessings of liberty. Share these stories, the articles, the podcasts, the videos with friends, with family, on social media. We learn by being exposed to new ideas, and you can help by exposing other people to the ideas of freedom and liberty and self-government. So go to AmericaOutloud.com and share the good news.
All right, you've all heard Malcolm and the great Dr. Peter McCullough talk about the povidone iodine-based nasal spray Cofix RX. They talk about it because it's a product that actually works in combating colds, flus, and coronaviruses. Cofix is made in the USA and recommended by thousands of doctors and pharmacists nationwide. It's simple. By attacking viruses where they incubate, you make it easier for your body to heal. Check out the Cofix RX banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and save 20% by using promo code OUTLOUD.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day, yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You rejoin the Constitution Study, and today, well, we're talking about protecting our children from our schools. And actually, it's more than just our schools. So as we dig into this, we find that a lot of the information that our schools are providing, well, they're getting from other resources. Now, it's quite probable that somewhere on your school, your child's school website, are links to sites that they may find helpful. And I wonder if one of those sites might be to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, the page, the CDC's webpage, LGBT Youth Assistance, has lots of resources to help teach your children about being weird. Well, for example, they point to a website called Q-Chat Space, which is designed to hide information from parents. But then again, the CDC website also has a page for parents, a page called healthychildren.org that talks about, you know, some children have a gender identity that is different from their gender assigned at birth. And how do parents reaffirm this alleged fact that gender is not what people tell you at birth. It's not, you know, it's not looking between the legs and going, it's a boy or it's a girl. You know, the Centers for Disease Control, which is supposed to be keeping statistics on diseases and stuff, it's giving information to help you and your child, well, be indoctrinated in a sexually perverse lifestyle. And, you know, again, it's divorced from reality. It's not simply that it's a sexually perverse lifestyle. Think about it. It says reality doesn't matter. Your biology doesn't matter. Your genetics, your chromosomes do not matter. It's how you feel. And we expect the world to simply rearrange itself based on how everybody feels. Which is why when I first saw this link, you know, it's pretty bad when a headline from a satire site makes more sense than what you're reading in the news. Now, I love the Babylon Bee. I subscribe to their feed. I get their the things because some of them are so funny. This one headline was great. It's called "Sneaky Parents Dress Son Up as a Girl on First Day of School So Teachers Will Show Him How to Be a Boy." And that, to me, wraps up the entire illogic, irrational nonsense of public education teaching about sexuality. See, it's no longer about the child. It's not even about the parent's wishes or the health of the child. No, it's about the agenda. And we see this more and more and more. It's one of the reasons why, you know, I do feel sorry. Now, I live in a rural area, right? I don't know probably as well as I should what the policies of our school district are. I'm not thoroughly impressed with what I've seen so far, but I'm not terribly frightened by it either. But it goes to show, ask yourself, what is your child being taught? If that Babylon Bee headline seems way too real to be true, if it's scary, how it's like, yeah, if I send my boy dressed up as a girl, then the teachers will teach him how to be a boy. That tells a lot about what the schools are doing. Now, call it indoctrination, call it grooming. It's the schools teaching our children to behave in a way that is, in the long term, dangerous, not just to themselves, but to society as a whole. And this whole idea that we turn over decision-making to the experts, that we have no information, we just listen to the experts. And how often the experts are not telling us the whole story. Well, for example, the FDA recently sent an update to the American Academy of Pediatrics warning that puberty blockers may cause brain swelling and blindness. Now, I don't see the rate. Nothing in the article I found talks about what percentage of those taking these drugs are experiencing these. But if they're warning physicians to watch out for these symptoms, then it's probably enough to pay attention to it. So if your school or your physician or somebody's telling you, well, give them puberty, we'll just delay puberty so that they can decide when they're a little older, that isn't without risk. And that's just some of the risk. I've heard reports that these puberty blockers can lead to long-term infertility. Again, for what is effectively a political, psychological agenda. And of course, if you're sending your kids to a government-run school, the government has certain inoculations that you're required to have. The sad part is they don't even bother testing them. Now, I don't know how well they were tested in the past. I've heard reports that most childhood vaccines do not go through proper safety testing. I don't know. I'm not an expert. I haven't researched that. But here's what I do know. I do know that when the CDC approved the COVID-19 quote-unquote vaccines for young children, I know that was not medically sound. Well, to start with, if you're talking children under 5 years old, the statistical likelihood that they will be hospitalized, much less die from COVID-19, it rounds to zero. It's in the 2 years, it's in the hundreds nationwide, not thousands, a couple of hundred. Now, granted, for a couple of hundred kids, that's a problem. I think it was last time I checked, it was like 250, 300 kids. That's a problem. And I would like to see treatment for those children. But the idea that we're going to try an experimental vaccine on children as young as 6 months should scare the snot out of every parent, especially one that's in a public school that has a vaccination requirement, including the medical experiment known as the Pfizer or Moderna, quote unquote, vaccines. But then it was found out that neither the CDC nor the FDA actually did any data analysis on the vaccine before recommending it to children. In fact, there's a group called the Protect the Public Trust. They call themselves a watchdog group. They noted that the CDC's own advisory committee on immunization practices found in June that there was low confidence that either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines, that they were slightly better at preventing the symptomatic COVID than the placebo. You see, Yale Medicine apparently released a report and they said, oh, look, we saw 37% effective among 6 months to 2 years. It was 51% for 6 months to 2 years old for the Moderna, 37% for 2 years to five. Not noting that that was pretty much the same numbers for the placebo group. In other words, the very CDC that many of you may be relying on for expert information are cooking the books. They're ignoring information that it doesn't confirm the idea of let's just shove these vaccines, these genetic modification tools into every American we can. And you're going to trust the government to protect your children now? The same government that violates the basic scientific process in testing these things, in testing these new experimental treatments. There's also evidence that the FDA and the CDC violated their own standards when they granted an emergency use authorization for these fake vaccines, when they recommended, especially under age 5. See, in order to be authorized as an emergency use authorization, one, it must be an emergency. Well, since we don't have children going to the hospital and dying in large numbers from COVID-19, it's not an emergency. Let's forget the fact there's actually safe, effective, and inexpensive treatments for COVID-19. We just ignore all of that. But imagine this. You're a parent, and you want to send your kid back to school, in-person schooling, and that school says, oh no, they must take one of the COVID-19 injections. Now, do you choose the substandard efficacy of the Moderna shot or the unreliable efficacy of the Pfizer shot based on what this government school is telling you? Now, you know me, I always like to close with what can we do? And I want to take some time to kind of mull that over with you. The first thing we have to do is, parents, you must take responsibility for the education of your child. Don't simply hand them to a government teacher and say, here, you teach them. Don't hand them to some bureaucrat and say, you control their education, their health care, you do that. No, we must be on top of it. We have to remember, government schools are full of government employees that work for the people, not the other way around. Expertise is no substitute for good common sense. Just because an expert tells you something doesn't mean it's true. They're human. Ask for the proof. Ask for the data. They must prove to you. You don't have to prove why not. They must prove to you why. You should be intimately aware of everything your child is being taught. And you must get in the face of the administrators when they don't. Now, in some places, they're going to get real uppity about that. They're going to get real antsy about that. They're going to hate the idea of parents actually getting involved. Just look at Virginia. You remember when one of the candidates said that parents have nothing to do are to have nothing to do with what's taught in schools, that must change. And that changes when the parents start standing up and saying, no, we're the parents, not you. We decide, not you. Now, it may involve getting friends and neighbors involved. Maybe it means running for a school board. Maybe it means simply taking time to meet and be involved with your school board. Maybe it means making some very tough decisions about the education of your child and what is a higher priority. We all make decisions. We all discriminate based on what we think is more valuable. We all make decisions about where we'll invest our time and our money and our effort, and we value certain things over others. Maybe it's about time we start valuing our children. Not simply, oh, I love them and hug them and kiss them and make sure they eat right. How about we take some time to making sure they're educated well? Maybe it's going to be some tough decisions for you. Like I said, my wife and I decided that one of us would not work because raising our child was more important. We had hoped to have more than one. We only have one, though. But it was more important to raise our child than to have that extra money for the new car or the vacation. That it was more important that we raise our child when she was young rather than, you know, sending her off to daycare so my wife could work because, you know, some social elite said, well, she should. Now, we had other choices. We chose what was best for us. And I'm not in your shoes. I don't know what is best for you. But I'm pretty sure, regardless of where you are, that there's the ability to be involved in the education of your children, to oversee it. I also think it's important for others of us that are caring and concerned to help those for whom that decision's even more difficult. I think of the single mom working, trying to raise her kid, could use a break, could use some time to maybe be involved, to go to a parent-teacher conference, could use some assistance raising things around. What can we do to help? What can we do, whether it's simply watching the kids for a while so she can go off and maybe get her hair done or just relax for an hour or two? Maybe it's to go to, a school meeting or a school board meeting or a parent-teacher conference. Maybe it's the ability to teach something. You know, we all have skills. We have the opportunity to teach others. When we were still homeschooling our daughter, there was a family that had several children, and I took every opportunity I could to teach them something. Some I taught public speaking. Some I taught building web pages. A few I even taught gun safety. But look for those opportunities to help others. I'm not saying it's a legal requirement, but it certainly, I would think, would be a moral requirement to help, especially those for whom that decision is even harder. You know, Hillary Clinton wrote a book that it takes a village to raise a child, and I disagree with that. But a village can help parents. A village can help the parents do more than they can do on their own. So let's assume the responsibility of raising our children. Let's offer our skills to help others. There's a reason why I travel the country teaching about the Constitution. And guess what? Unless people charge for admission, I don't charge them to do this. Yes, if they can help pay my travel and living costs, that's great. But there's a reason why I invest in teaching children, teaching the rising generation to be free, because I know they're not getting it in most of their schools. What can you do to help? Consider that. Think about that for the rest of the day. What can you do to help educate children in your family, in your neighborhood, in your state, in your country? Then when you find something you can do to help, let's do it. Let's stop being dependent on government. Let's stop blindly following the experts. Let's be a free and independent people. And let's learn from our mistakes and stop depending on government to educate Because what they really are doing is indoctrinating them to being dependent on government. And you cannot be a free and independent people if you have generations being taught to be dependent on government. Now, I hope you found this episode interesting. I hope I maybe brought up some things you hadn't thought about. Most of all, I hope it encourages you to take responsibility for the education of your children. And for those of us that have the skills, that we can help educate other children when given the opportunity. And if you found this useful, do me a favor. Share this information with others. Share this program with others. Let them know they can listen to the Constitution Study weekdays at 4 p.m. on America Out Loud Talk Radio, heard on the iHeartRadio Network. They can listen through the website, through the media player, or on our apps for Apple, Android, or Alexa. If they can't listen weekdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, they can listen on a podcast. It generally shows up a day or two after the broadcast. They can listen on their favorite podcast app. All that asks them to do is subscribe, and if they can, rate the show on Apple Podcasts. It helps others find the Constitution Study as well. Now, you can find all the links you need on the homepage at AmericaOutLoud.com. But do me a favor. Don't keep them to yourself. Share them. Join the cause as we share the blessings of liberty from sea to shining sea.